All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. And tonight, we're doing a James Bond flick for the first time ever on the show. And I'm not sure why we've shied away from him, but I do have a theory. And we'll get into that a little bit as we discuss this one with our friend, the professional asshole, who's going to be joining us in just a few minutes when we get to the last narrative portion of the show. But you can find the show notes and more for this at actualanarchy.com/210, I believe. Just me reconfirm that with M at the home office. And yes, that is correct. Let's check in with Robert over at Station O. How are things going over there?
You know, I'm glad you asked me about the chickens, Daniel. I am so excited. It was just a little over 2 short weeks ago where you made this fool's errand of a bet wager with me that the chickens were going to go under 10 wins for the season. And they have since won 2 straight back-to-back games in chickeny, dominy, nation-y fashion. And I can just smell, taste, and I can feel the vibrations of the money Marky Mark style coming my way. It's so delicious and tantalizing. It is an inevitability. It is like a train rushing towards you with a computer program with his arm around your head. And he says, can you hear that? That is the sound of inevitability, Daniel, of you being that much poorer and me that being that much richer. Because you've got monster man children, chicken masters dominating the gridiron. And there's nobody that can stop them except for the people that can stop them. But there aren't enough people to stop them in time for you to win the bet.
All right. You chess master, you. You are correct. Now, just so that the folks at home know what the hell you're talking about, the chickens are, of course, the nickname for the Seattle Seahawks Football Club, who have the league's worst defense in all the history of defenses. And so my bet with you was for the trading places $1 on who was going to come out on top in this matching of wits that you and I have on whether the Seahawks will win 10 wins or not. Now, yeah, they're on their way and they're playing terrible teams coming up. But as they oft do, as all Seattle teams do, when it comes to crunch time, they blow it against the worst competition. I suspect they will lose to a team as lowly as the Jets. If they play them, I don't even know. Do they play the Jets?
Yes, they do play the Jets,
Daniel.
They will
lose to the Jets. Let's double or nothing. It's a $2 bet now. They will lose to the Jets and not win 10 games.
Wow. Dig that hole a little bit deeper there, sir. That's a fantastic. I will take that sucker bet any day of the week. You know, they do have the world's worst defense. It's true. But they are leading the league in perhaps the most important category. Do you know what category that is, Daniel?
Having an amazing receiver named DK Metcalf and a miraculous quarterback that they let cook.
They do lead the league in having those two players. It's true. They are the only team that have a DK Metcalf and a Russell Wilson. All the other teams do have zero of those two players. So they, by default, have it is science. You can't question it. But no, the stat I was referring to is the fact that they have zero COVID infections on the year. So if they can maintain that, so not only do teams have to watch out for the injury bug, they also have to watch out for the COVID bug. And every other team has had, I think, at least one, and the chickens have had zero. So if they can just avoid, I think Denver just played a game a few days ago. Well, yesterday, right?
Without a quarterback, yeah.
2 days. Without a single... They grabbed a wide receiver from their backup squad.
Or they haven't had a quarterback since Elway.
Since Manning. Manning was a quarterback, Daniel. He's Hall of Famer. You remember him. But it's true. Yeah, they played without a quarterback, and it was hilarious. I think they got one completion the entire game. It's impressive. Maybe two, something like that. They had more interceptions than they did have completions. And that's because of this stupid COVID nonsense where they had some quarterbacks on their team exposed to COVID, even though they tested negative over and over and over again. The NFL in their stupid whatever still says, no, you can't play because dumb rules. But, you know, whatever. So, yeah, I'm excited for my chickens, and I'm excited for my giant windfall coming my way. It's going to be exciting. I don't know what I'm going to spend it on yet. I'll think about it later. First, yeah, I got to roll around in it for a while.
Scrooge McDuck style. Now, it's probably going to be $2 at this point because I just bet on the Jets. By the way, we have a Jets fan who's reached out to us on the Twitters. I'm not banned on Twitter yet.
What are you talking about?
And he's offered to be a guest for 12 Years a Slave. So we're going to try to make that arrangement in the next couple of weeks. I have a few other episodes lined up, but I think that will be a fun one to discuss with him. He's a high school history teacher, but he teaches in the Tom Woods Dangerous History podcast kind of style.
Very nice. Very nice. That's cool. Yeah, he sounds like a good guy.
All right.
He's any kind of like our Prof CJ episode. That'd be good. We did Saving Private Ryan with him?
We did do Saving Private Ryan with him. Yes, we did. And that's a good episode. I'll put that on our show notes page because it needs a little more exposure. I think that we did a fine job trying to hang with him. He had a lot of good info for us on that one. But speaking of good info, I have an expert on the Sean Connery isms in this James Bond film. And we will introduce him in just a moment as we get into the last night's portion of the show. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson, now going by Bubonic Chronic on the episode tonight. You can find his wares at Trubster.com. You can find the episode we're doing tonight, From Russia with Love, at lastnighters.com/153. And I'll just throw this out there. If you like what we do, throw some money our way at our Patreon, lastnighters.com/Patreon. I got a great bonus from someone I Patreon to recently, Snobby Bobby of the Not For Everyone podcast. I just Patreon to them, and Adam, his co-host, made art of me and another Patreon person that looks like a stick figure anarchist symbol. So it was pretty cool. So big ups to Adam and Snobby Bobby over at the Not For Everyone podcast. And you can find our Patreon at lastnighters.com/Patreon. And perhaps, Robert, you are quite the artiste, if I may say so myself. I don't know if you'd be willing to throw something like that out, but maybe there's something we can come up with.
No, it was cool. You showed me the picture. It was not anything I could get to be as good at that as that. But, you know, for your, I'm sure you probably Patreoned him for a few pennies. So, you know, you probably got what you paid for on that one.
I Patreon him $5 foot long every month.
Subway sandwich every month. A Subway sandwich from 2007 every month. Nice.
Yeah. Actually, I heard that, Subway sandwiches in some legal proceeding could not be considered technically a sandwich, or their bread can't be considered actually bread, something like that. I'll have to look that up. But speaking of people who look up trite and stupid nonsense just to prove a point, thus being an asshole, we have, of course, the professional asshole has been with us many, many times in the past, who is behind the scenes here. If he can unmute, we can introduce him. Welcome back to the show, professional asshole.
Howdy, guys. How you doing?
We're doing mighty fine, especially now that you're here. We're doing an episode in honor of the passing of the great Sean Connery. And you had picked out this particular film because, well, in some of the private groups that we're part of, you have a certain persona that would lend one to think that they support the behavior of one James Bond played by Sean Connery in this particular movie. So I'm sure we can get into that on this one. But this is not your first rodeo, so we'll have all your previous appearances down on the show notes page, lastnighters.com/153. But welcome back.
Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, it is unfortunate to find out that Sean Connery passed away on Halloween this year. for anybody who didn't already know, if you're not paying attention to the news. So very unfortunately, we lost Legend, who was well-versed in the art of smacking women, openly bragged about it. And openly told Barbara Walters that he refused to change his mind on the matter.
Well, you know, you stick to your guns because apologies usually don't get you where you think you want to go, right? Isn't that the thing? Like, if you're not in the wrong, don't apologize. Granted, I think hitting women probably not the best thing.
Well, you're not Sean Connery, so how would you know?
That's true. But also, not hitting them, wouldn't that be sexist because you're treating them differently based on their sex? I don't know. It's over my pay grade.
But, hey, did any of you guys pay attention to when he died, what the reaction from the Twitter sphere was? I know when Stan Lee died, a whole bunch of keyboard warriors came out and said, thank God he's dead. What a horrible racist human being, blah, blah, blah. Did Sean Connery get ex post facto canceled?
No, I don't think he did. And the reason is because there's just so many women were so overwhelmingly attracted to him. I mean, he was named sexiest man of the century when he was like 70 years old.
Yeah, 1999. Yeah,
exactly. Because women simply crave getting smacked, I guess. I don't know. just they can't help themselves. Same thing happened to Chris Brown. His popularity went way up after he beat the crap out of Rihanna.
Wow. All right. Well, for the record, wife, I don't condone any of this. This is all just satire and conjecture. Anyway, how we usually start this off is not with so much misogyny, but with the Google description. So I'm going to pull that up now. And we'll get into this episode on From Russia with Love, the second Bond film. It came out in 1963, rated PG, action adventure film, 1 hour and 58 minutes. Got a 7.4 on the IMDb, 95% Rotten Tomatoes, and 84% on the Metacritic, and 91% of Google users liked it. The description reads, Agent 007, played by Sean Connery, is back in the second installment of the James Bond series, this time battling a secret crime organization known as Spectre. Russians Rosa Kleb and Kronstein are out to snatch a decoding device known as the Lector, using the ravishing Tatiana, to lure Bond into helping them. Bond willingly travels to meet Tatiana in Constantinople, where he must rely on his wits to escape with his life in a series of deadly encounters with the enemy. Release date of May 27, 1964, director Terrence Young, and he also, he was the body double for Pedro Armendariz, who was dying of cancer. This was his last film. And budget $2 million, it made a heck of a lot more than that. And one of Sean Connery's better films, I think. This is often listed as one of the better Bond films, I think. So with that, Robert, I'll go to your opening salvo.
Wow. If this is one of his best movies, I don't know what to say. This is not a good movie. This is a slow, pondering, meandering film that doesn't seem to... It sets up a pretty decent, interesting premise. Like, we start off with these bad guys at this chess tournament. And you've got this super mega brain guy. He's set up to be the super mega brain guy who's thought out every computation of possibilities that could happen. And so he's developed this perfect plan to get this Lecter and to defeat the James Bond. And you're like, okay, great. I'm strapped in. This is a good start. I like this idea. I'm fully on board with this cartoonish, you know, you get Blofeld, you get number two, you get number three, you get all the things that, you know, Austin Powers so famously made fun of. And it's very cartoonish, but I'm on board. But then you get into the actual story, and I just think it's too long. It's a lot of, you could definitely see the low budget. A lot of it doesn't really hold up over time. There's a lot of rear screen projection, which I can't really fault it too much for. That's kind of the technology they had at the time. And I guess you don't want to put your stars in danger of actually, you know, being in a movie. Well, there was one where they're like really far away from like the helicopter on fire. And that was still a rear screen projection for some reason. I don't know. I want to get into some of the things I really, really hated about this movie. But I will just say that Sean Connery had way better performances. If you want to see a fun Sean Connery movie, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. There are probably all kinds of other movies in the 80s where Connery was like kind of at the height of his acting powers, where he did like real movies with the like Rock. Real scripts.
Entrapment.
Yeah, even The Rock is a lot of fun. But I'm sure there are other films, I mean, Hunt for Red October, those kinds of things, that are more serious. This is like a, I don't even know what this, what genre you would put this in. It's not like a crime caper movie. It's, man, I don't even know what this is. It's just a James Bond movie. It's not an action adventure movie. There's none of that. There's one like shootout kind of punch 'em up scene at the gypsy place. And then there's a weird boat scene at the end. And then there's a one fist fight with the one bad guy. And other than that, it's just all talking.
With Daniel Craig.
All talking and standing around. And that is it. So I think these older Bond movies, I think people are looking at them with some rose-colored glasses on. Maybe people remember them being better than they were, because this, I thought, was slow and bizarre and weird. And I didn't even get a sense that Bond was up against this mega brain challenge of this, all these forces, you know, lined up against him, and every movie he makes, he's just constantly getting countered by this super brain. You didn't get any of that. The setup didn't match the movie that I saw. It just seemed like he was in Istanbul. Okay. And he's walking around and he's kind of doing spy stuff a little bit, but more than not, he's just kind of hanging out. So I don't know. He's banging chicks and he's punching a guy, but it's, I hate to be the guy that always shits on movies, but this really isn't that good. But I'm eager to hear what other people have to say, if you guys had a more positive experience with this thing.
Wrong.
Excellent counter. I have been put in my place.
All right. So Professional Asshole is going to fact check you.
Wrong.
All right. So Professional Asshole, this was the movie you selected. So I'm sure that you have some rebuttal to what my hater here is saying about your favorite film.
Yeah.
Well, aside from the fact that it's establishing a lot of the genres that are going to be used later, and you know, using the techniques and the stunt, the special effects and stunt work that becomes standard for Hollywood later, like, you know, Robert was so easy to criticize that helicopter yep. scene. And it's like, look, this is this is being filmed in 1962. Helicopters had only just been introduced as a viable technology. And they decided to have him, you know, they decided to blow one up, you know, in an open field based on, the AR-7 that Bond was using, which was, again, a brand new rifle being used at the time. So you're criticizing, this is like criticizing Casablanca because, you know, it's in black and white. Like, yeah, no shit.
You're really going to defend the scene where yes. Bond takes one shot at this helicopter, magically hits the guy in the shoulder. He shoots the guy in the shoulder and the guy's like, oh, I'm hit. Rub, rub, rub some ketchup on my chest. Oh, and then he drops the grenade in his lap, which blows up the helicopter.
Yes, I absolutely am. They have established Bond as being an expert marksman. From like the opening scene in every one of the movies has him shooting a guy down the barrel of a gun.
Okay, right. Okay. So you brought up the helicopter scene. Well, actually, I brought up the helicopter scene, but you're responding to my helicopter scene. So we're gonna talk about the helicopter scene. All right. Okay. So they're driving down this country in this pickup
truck.
This
is like Albania. Yeah.
And along comes this helicopter with a guy who's got a submachine gun. And instead of having the high ground and then just shooting the people down in the truck, and they could do nothing to stop you, they buzz the tower over and over again, like over and over again. They're just buzzing the tower, strafing, yeah. buzzing the tower.
Trying to give this to end? Copy.
To make him poop his pants?
They did the exact same thing in Lethal Weapon. I don't hear you criticizing them. They literally have the daughter drive away in a limousine while the helicopter chases it and like strafes over the top of it until she crashes.
They also, so Bond gets out of the truck and then he's running around.
Yeah.
And then they strafe him. And all he has to do is like fall over. And
you mean just like You mean in just like in North by Northwest?
If you're bringing up better movies in defense of this crap fest, you're going to have to do better than that. They're totally different context.
Nah, man, you are just a hater. You are a hater.
All he's got to do is stop and hover, which is what a helicopter can do really, really good.
Yeah.
They can just hover. And then he can pull out his machine gun and mow Bond the fuck down. And I know then the movie's over and whatever, but it would make way more sense and produce a much more credible threat than to have somebody just like flapping his wings around you.
All right. So the other reason I happen to really love this movie is it's just so seepingly sexist. I mean, that's just one of the most amazing things about it is the fact that it just assumes hilarious tropes about women. Like, you know, right at the beginning, they get this, this intelligence dossier and Emma's saying, so apparently there's this woman named Tatiana Romanova who's she just fell in love with you by looking at your picture. And she wants to give you one of these Lecter machines. So you're going to go down to Istanbul and you're going to pick it up and you're going to woo her. And, you know, she said she'll only give it to you. And everybody's sort of like, I mean, it's believable that a woman would just fall in love with a picture of somebody without knowing. Because, I mean, women do it all the time. They fall in love with movie stars by looking at posters. And, you know, they're basically like children. I know this is a trap, but it's still completely believable that a woman would fall in love with a person just by looking at a picture. Which is great, you know.
Defend that, Daniel. Continue on with that thought, please. I'm eager to hear this.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure they can, but in the context of the film, they do see right through it and say it's obviously a trap, but they're still willing to do it because there's a chance of getting this Lecter, which is a decoding machine that they can break the code of transmissions from the enemy. And I guess at the time it was the USSR, right? 1962, Cold War style. So, you know, yep. They had to come up with a way to advance the plot. I don't know, you know, how different the book is, but it was one of Kennedy's favorite books. And this was apparently the last film he saw before he went to Dallas. So that sort of relates back
makes
to
it even more tragic.
A movie that we did a few weeks ago.
Robert, you are such a hater, man.
the most interesting scene in the film takes place when the two spies are alone together in the train car. That is the most interesting scene when they're talking about the tools of the trade and how they're both professionals and how this is going to go down and this, that, and the other. And it's actually a scene where there's some tension and, you know, Bond's going to come out on top because he's the Superman character.
And then 38 more films.
Right. But it's still, there's some scene with some interesting conflict there. And I thought that was by far the most engaging and fun scene in the film.
Yeah, Quint really did a great performance.
There's some praise for your little movie. I know you're simping hardcore for this movie, but it's not going to have sex with you.
All right. Now, in my reading of this film, and I saw it once like 20 years ago, they used to do like TNT marathons of Bond films, like around Thanksgiving, I want to say, something like that. And then I saw it again when I got the Bond set on DVD, and my wife and I watched all of them early on in our marriage. And it's mostly like it's popcorn filler, you know, it's candy. It's cotton candy for you. It's for entertainment purposes. Some of the Bond films are actually far worse. I'm looking at you, Thunderball, and A View to a Kill, though that does have Grace Jones in it and Christopher Walken. So it's a tough call. Maybe it's not the Bond. Moonraker's pretty bad. But you got Jack.
Pretty slapstick. Yeah.
Yeah. But this is the one that kind of introduces a lot of the things that they use throughout the franchise. Like Dr. No was kind of a, you know, one-off. It did really well. But it was this film, From Russia with Love, where they introduced like the opening scene and then the musical number with the title screens and like a lot of the quippy dialogue and like one-liners she'll say after somebody dies or blows up or gets thrown in the lake. And I think a lot of those changed how films were scripted going forward. You know, this is where you got the I'll Be Back and the, you know, the Schwarzenegger and the Stallone.
Around.
Right. Yeah. So without Connery doing this in this film right here
is to blame for the quippy one-liners from the 80s action films.
Blame. No,
to blame.
That's what makes those films so great.
It makes them memorable. That's not what makes them great.
What is up with Robert and criticizing the 80s, man? The 80s was a great time. There was like cocaine everywhere. The steroids were pharmaceutical grade. You know, the action heroes literally chopped people's heads off with Bowie knives and snap necks like they were, you know, carrot sticks. I mean, what the heck is wrong with you? Man, these were great times.
They are, even if they're great, they are not without criticism. They are not perfect films. Although Predator is one of my favorite movies of all time. It's endlessly rewatchable. I don't know if you can even come up with a whole lot of criticism for it, but it's not perfect. But it is, it came out in the 80s and it's fantastic.
Yeah, that's one we got to do, actually.
I don't know about you, man. I wish I had.
Dylan, you son of a bitch.
I had been like 25 in like 1980, so that I could have all my best years in the 80s, making money, doing blow, being roided up out of the kills.
Yeah,
driving Ferraris, exactly. You know, like just great times, man. Is there a sexier woman on the planet than Maggie Thatcher? I mean, my God, what a woman!
Yeah, we just
Thatcher.
Yeah, hell yeah.
What the hell are we talking about here? The Iron Woman from Great Britain?
She gives me the thickest boner.
Wow. All right. Well, I'm going to deflect a little bit and just say I've touched a nerve related to Thunderball. Perhaps they like Never Say Never Again a little bit better. The total remake.
What in the hell is happening?
You are just wrong, my friend.
All right. Well, all right. I do have a question for you guys.
Okay.
Do you think that Daniel Craig got brought on as Bond because he looks so much like Grant?
Grant? Who's Grant?
That's the assassin, and that's Robert Shaw's character.
Yeah, the assassin is like the guardian angel for Bond. He's like protecting him while framing him until he gets to Lecter.
I doubt that had a whole lot to do with it.
Plot. I thought that part was really good too. You get your adversaries to fight each other so that the victor is in a weakened state. I thought that was pretty brilliant.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent tactic for sure. So that's something to be said for the plot. I will grant you that.
Yeah, like you were saying, I think it has a really strong premise. However, a lot of the elements from that premise don't make a lot of sense. Like, why was Tatiana and Bond like sneaking around on her delivering the floor plan to Bond at the Sophia, right? Is that where they went?
Hagia Sophia.
Yeah. Why do that when she was just in his hotel room the night before? Yeah. Like,
why interview her on a boat?
Right. Yeah. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And then it turns out that his buddy, Karen Bay, gets the plans from the city planner. And it's like, oh, look at this. Her plan, her sketch matches the plans. So you already had the information. And he was already, you know, had the periscope in there under in the catacombs. Like he knew where he was. So a lot of the elements in this just don't make a lot of sense. Like, I think they were just injecting spy-ness into this so that it, I don't know, they were trying to spice it up a little maybe.
Yeah, I just got the sense that one scene didn't really lead into the other very strongly. It seemed like you could reorder a lot of the scenes and it'd make about as much sense. It didn't really, when I was trying to follow along with the plot, I was trying to ask myself, okay, why are they doing this? Why are they doing that? And I shouldn't really have to ask myself that. It should be obvious and apparent. You should be on board with, oh, now he's got to do this. Okay, this is exciting. Okay, how's he going to do this? Okay, this is fun.
Right.
Why are they all of a sudden in the Hagia Sophia? Why? And why is somebody getting killed and he's prying something out of the guy's hand? Why does this guy have the thing? And
Yeah, basically things are just kind of happening and it doesn't make a lot of sense. And similarly, the helicopter and the boat chase scene just seem like tacked on for extra action. Because it doesn't make sense why it would happen and how Spectre would know where Bond is with which to send a team of boats after him, the green boat and the red boat, and the black boat.
If they know where he's at, why don't they just have a hit squad come and get him?
Because they don't actually have the Lecter machine themselves and they want to get it too, but they want Bond to be the one who delivers it to them while taking the fall and being disgraced.
Why do they give a shit about Bond being disgraced?
Because he's embarrassed them a few times before, so it's revenge.
For killing Dr. No.
Okay, I didn't really pick up on that, so I blame
the beginning scene. It's in that beginning scene where they, after the chess match, and the guy's like, oh, the guy they would use for this is James Bond, and you know, number one, who is later revealed to be Blofeld, is like, yeah, we want to get rid of him. We really don't like him.
Okay.
All right. Well, any other points that either of you guys want to make? I mean, we haven't really talked much about this just yet. I guess one point I'd like is that even though there was tension between the USSR and the Americans and the British, they show in this film that the individual people are still, you have more in common with the other individuals of an adversarial country than you do with the you know, the tensions of the country itself or among the countries. Do you get what I'm trying to say here? Like,
yes.
I like that Tatiana was an actual person who had good qualities, and Bond saw that, even though there was some subterfuge that she was forced into when Krebs was like, if you don't agree to do this, you're not going to leave this room alive. So she was obviously coerced into doing this, but it is believable, at least within the film, that, you know, she does grow an attachment to Bond and, you know, really likes him despite them being from adversarial countries.
I especially thought it was interesting the way Kleb asked Tatiana how many men she'd been with. And she was like, three. Like, that was supposed to be like, whoa, really? Almost on the edge of what, you know, whether or not that was going to disqualify her for the mission.
Like, that's a scandalous number?
Yeah. In 1958 or something, that's a scandalous number.
Yeah, let's talk about the, I'm not going to bring this up normally, but the misogyny, I guess you could say, of this film. I saw a couple different scenes where I identified with my amazing perception powers. So there's one scene where Bond casually slaps the girl on the ass.
I do that all the time.
Which, you know, I think is totally fine and normal and fine.
Yeah.
And she didn't seem to mind it at all. But I think if you're a modern day feminist, you probably, like, I don't know, rolling over in your grave or something when you see that. But then there was one scene, the gypsy scene, which I felt was even a little bit over the top, where these two girls are fighting over the opportunity to marry the leader's son. And then they're attacked by what? Russians or some other force? It wasn't really clear who was attacking.
Yeah, it was Russians, yeah.
Okay. But then, since Bond saves the life of the gypsy king, then the king's like, yo, you can decide the outcome of this, these two girls fighting. And Bond's like, all right. And so then the girls come in and then he bangs both of them, of course. And then the next day, they are fawning all over him and like licking his boots and like darning his socks and, you know, just do all this like super overt, like worship type stuff. And I was like, okay, even for me, this is a bit much that they are just fawning all over this uber, you know, alpha male guy who just banged them once. I was like, okay, that's, I could see a feminist's point here at this point here. I was like, okay, you got something, ladies.
But again, that is that's exactly how Sean Connery was in real life, right? And again, he was such an open misogynist, right? Like, he openly talked about how he thought slapping women was fine. And, you know, he would regularly cheat on his wife. And he didn't even hide it. I mean, you see this interview where he's with Barbara Walters. And he's got his wife has painted a picture of him in a bathrobe without his underwear on, so you can see his dick hanging out. And he's got it on the wall, just admiring himself. Like, isn't that a great painting of me? Look at, you know, and he's in like this very skimpy gold robe, smoking a cigar, having a brandy, you know, just clearly not giving a shit about anybody. And that's exactly how he was in real life. And hands down, he was overwhelmingly voted, you know, sexiest man of the century. He was voted sexiest man of the year like three times and then voted sexiest man of the century. So when feminists say, oh, you know, it's like, I hate men like that. It's like, yeah, but you keep sleeping with them. So, you know, that's on you.
Oh, yeah. I'm fully on board with that. Like, as much as feminists decry you know, men who are whatever toxic masculinity and that sort of thing. You don't see women throwing themselves and sleeping with these beta male soy boys.
No,
you see them sleeping and, you know, having sex with all these kind of alpha dudes. So yeah, that's what you're attracted to.
Yeah. That's, I mean, that's exactly it. It's, you know, you complain about a guy who slaps women, but if you look globally, you know, domestic violence and number of children born per women are like exactly correlated. You know, I mean, that's not to say that there's necessarily a cause there, but it is to say that the more often women get smacked in society, the more likely they are to have like five kids. So, you know, it's not a deterrent is all I'm saying. But anyways, the point is, of course, that, yeah, it's the fact that it's Connery's attitude, not only in his personal life, but as Bond, that does seem to make women sort of fawn like that, because that's exactly what they do. And they did it in real life, too. So to say that it's unbelievable, well, yeah, it's generally unbelievable. But then at the same time, again, I mentioned Chris Brown earlier. His popularity shot way up after he beat Rihanna. It's like, don't ask me why. I'm not approving of it. But, you know, they seem to be like, oh, that's okay. Yeah. You know, it's just one consideration among many. If he's got other good qualities, I'll just sort of overlook that. You know, he's not mean to me. He's not a jerk to me.
Right. It doesn't seem to be the deal breaker that you generally think it to be in this day and age.
Right.
I think it's different for a guy that, like, I would view that as a deal breaker. But
that's because you're a guy.
Allegedly. We're going to fact check that. But
for now, he is. We'll see.
For now. Well, anyway, this is a spicy episode already. But speaking of the gypsy thing, I found it incredible that they would be attacked by this group of Russians who are shooting people, murdering people, and then escaping, and then they just proceed with the evening as if nothing untoward had occurred. That I found to be unbelievable.
Is that the most unbelievable thing you found in this movie, Daniel?
Yes. Yeah. The gypsies being attacked and then pretending like everything was fine is the most incredulous thing I saw in this movie.
Is it a deal breaker for you?
It might be. Yeah, it might be. It might have broke the plot for me.
Gypsies were big partiers, though.
You know? Yeah. And what was the whole point of going there? He was going to get help from the gypsies. Karen Bay was bringing him there. And it was also supposedly that the Russians wouldn't expect them to go there because Karen Bay had hit one of his sons, who all of his sons work for him, because you can trust him, apparently. Going the other way.
In my opinion.
Right. In the rolls with dummies in the back to throw him off the scent. Obviously didn't work. Because that assassin dude was right there and attacked the gypsy camp.
Right.
So it's like, they do some spy stuff, but it never seems to like result in, you know, spy action happening.
Right. And yeah, and this is part of my criticism of this film is just that he gets to Istanbul and the plot really should be, okay, now we've got like something for you to do immediately. And then there's going to be another thing that happens due to that. But instead the spy chief master guy, I forget, what is his name?
Karen Bay.
He's just like, well, there's not really much for you to do. So just, you know, hang out. Don't go back to the hotel, but, you know, just whatever. And that's really what happens in the movie. They're just like, well, we could go to this gypsy place. I don't know. It's fun. And well, it happens that there's plot things that happen, but not due to any particular reason.
Well, and I think he described that he had to go to the gypsy place anyway. So Bond might as well come along with him because he obviously, you know, Karen Bay was operating all sorts of illegal activities throughout all of Istanbul. In fact, for those of you guys who don't know, Karen is just a Turkish word that means like chief. So calling him Karen Bay is just like chief Bay.
Okay.
Or something like, you know, we would use the word boss or something like that. But yeah, it's like, well, I already had business. I have to go visit these gypsies anyways. It's on my schedule. So why don't you come with me since you can't go to the hotel?
Right. Which it just seems so. What do we do for this scene? What do we do for this chunk of the movie? I don't know. We're just going to film them hanging out.
Right. But while they're hanging out, Grant is framing murders of Russian agents on Bond, right? And then there's retaliation from the Russians by blowing up Karen Bay's office and nearly killing him after he's turned down his woman for sex.
Which he describes as, you know, back to the salt mines. And she's coming over like, come over and take a break with me. Oh, I want you so bad. And he's like, oh, God, back to the salt mines.
And then the explosion. But the explosion was retaliation from the Russians thinking that it was Bond who had killed the guy tailing them. Because when Karen Bay's son picks him up from the airport, picks up Bond from the airport. And I like that they have the little challenge phrase thing. Like, you need a light? Oh, I prefer a lighter. Or a match is better, or whatever they say. I thought that was really cool, you know, to see that kind of a thing. But
yeah, and that's a real thing from history, right? I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily, I'm sure this probably does take place in spy talk in the spy world. But like back in back in World War II, the Allies had different code words to identify friendlies with. They would say, you know, thunder, flash, that kind of thing. So you would right. know whether or not you were, you know, running into a German pretending to be an American or whatever.
Right. And he said that, you know, when they're being tailed by the Citroen, that there was a mutual like acknowledgement that they follow us, we follow them. It's, you know, there's like this understanding, there's this like mild tension. But then when Grant is killing people and the Russians think it's Bond, then there's the retaliation. So there's that fighting fish, like the instigation going on, getting those two to fight each other. And I think that's really what they're trying to propel here. By just having Bond just be there and not really have to do anything in particular just yet, because they have to set this up to where there's this buildup of retaliation from the Russians.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not the worst film in the world. It's just, I think if it was done in today's world,
it's no high rise.
No, it would have a plot. There would be things that would need to happen in an order. I think it'd be a much tighter. I mean, as long as it was handled well, there'd be more action and it would be a tighter. And there wouldn't just be these tacked on weirdo action scenes shot on a rear screen projector. None of the real action was integrated into the plot except for the one fist fight, spy fight in the train scene. I don't know. What do you even call it? How would you label this film?
It's a spy film. That's why it's genre setting, because it was a spy film. It wasn't a heist movie, although it had elements of heist, and it wasn't like an escape movie, although it had elements of escape, and but it's a spy film. It's setting the genre for spy film. You know, if you have things that come afterwards, I'm trying to think of other movies post this era that use the honeypot as a element. I mean, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade kind of does uses the honeypot. But yeah, I mean, it's genre defining film, which is why it's early and acceptable for these things to have happened.
Which is why you are simping for it. I understand. It's okay to do this. It's okay. When someone comes along and is a trailblazer, they are bound to inspire others to do better and to improve on it. So I will give it props for being one of the first of its kind.
See, we have gotten Robert from saying this is an awful movie to it's not so bad to I'll give it props
for inspiring other people to come along and actually make good movies.
This is how badasses like myself come along and change minds. At first, I start by just saying wrong. And you're like, okay, I guess I have to make some better arguments. I was refuted. You even admitted it. And so now you have to move along from saying bad wrong. Film to, oh, not so bad, to I give
well,
it props.
It's terrible.
It is terrible. Nah, you're still wrong, but it's okay.
It has historical merit in the sense that you could unearth it and go, hey, look at this. One of the first spy movies.
Don't ever use the word smart with me.
All right. So our professional asshole has clearly read The Art of
You graduated like second to last in your class. Don't ever do that.
All right. Well, if we could collect ourselves, what do you guys think of the whole notion of the Lecter in and of itself? Like, wasn't there a machine called, I want to say, the Enigma?
Yep.
Yes.
So that was used by the Germans in World War II.
But there were also alternate. I mean, after Germany fell, Enigma machines went out and they were quickly replicated, and they changed the settings inside in order to change the encryption codes. But I mean, cryptography was very important throughout the entirety of the 50s. I mean, it continues to be today, but the cryptography today is really advanced.
Okay, I'm going to take us on a turn here based on this, the Lector and the Enigma and the cracking of codes. And as we're approaching December 7th, the Pearl Harbor attack day, I haven't researched this in a while, but I believe I've looked into this a bit and that the code had been cracked, the Japanese code had been cracked, so that there was forewarning or foreknowledge of a site being attacked in the Pacific on a specific date or imminent, and that these warnings, these cracked codes were ignored or swept under the rug so that these things were allowed to happen. Does that sound accurate to either of you guys?
I've heard the theory before that FDR knew of the likelihood of a Japanese attack, and especially the Secretary of the Navy was familiar with it and was even trying to warn FDR of that day. But the problem, as my understanding goes, is that we had cracked part of the Japanese code so that we understood certain words, but we didn't actually have their entire encryption database. So we only knew maybe 10 to 15% of the words that were coming through transmission. So we would get bits and pieces, and we get the idea that they were planning an attack, but we did not know exactly when and where.
I think the important lesson in all of that was, even if they didn't know exactly when and where it was going to happen, the idea was, though, that the United States was absolutely poking Japan and prodding them and provoking them into an attack. They were had embargoes on all kinds of stuff over in Southeast Asia. They were strangling them economically.
Like Grant in the opening scene of this film.
Exactly. They were making it so that Japan had no choice but to either attack the United States and enter them into the war so that they could get into the Philippines and other places in order to get like resources. They were starving for oil. And even towards the end of the war, like, they were so oil starved that the Japanese Navy was running on unrefined oil, like almost pure crude, at the towards the end of the war, like through like two, like three quarters, like from 1943, late 1943 on, they're like running on pure crude, which is just insane. They're so starved for oil. So yeah, they were trying to get, they knew that Japan was starving and that they would soon attack. At least that's how I understand it.
Okay, well, this is another thing I probably should have like researched a bit more prior to this episode. I wasn't even considering talking about Pearl Harbor at all when we were talking about a James Bond film. However, since we're talking about the cryptography, and that sparked a memory in my old man head here as I'm getting older and older and more forgetful. But do you guys have any final notes you want to discuss before we get into the final summary and review?
Yeah, I didn't really take a lot of notes. I took my first notes when he was started slapping the girl, and then when the helicopter scene happened, and then I was like, this is some dumb bullshit. So I wrote down a few things, but other than that,
I want to point out that, of course, as a good capitalist, which Bond later becomes not so good a capitalist in his later movies, but early on he is given by his government 50 gold sovereigns in order to make his way through Istanbul and all the way back. And I looked up what 50 gold sovereigns would be worth hidden in a briefcase. It's about $21,500 in today's money. So back then, probably even worth more. So yeah, they gave him a solid $30,000, and he was smuggling bullets, through countries and, concealed knives and all that stuff. So, I mean, guy's a straight up libertarian badass.
Those were the days, man.
I know, exactly.
A libertarian badass who works for the secret service of MI5?
There would be private intelligence companies in Ancapistan. What the hell are you talking about?
Private intelligence companies that operate above the law.
Of course.
Licensed to kill?
Yeah, there is no law in Ancapistan. Haven't you heard of Somalia?
All right,
Kami. All right.
Me. We're gonna have to step outside.
Well, Robert, I'm pretty sure I know what you're.
I will judo chop you and make you instantly go unconscious. Like as soon as I like touch your neck, you're like instantly out.
I do like that Dick Connery has such prowess in knocking people out with a single tap.
Oh yeah, you just hit him on the back of the head once, and they're like out for as long as the script needs them to be out.
Yeah, Spock was like that too, man. You know, he just come up, be like, "Sir, you have something on your shoulder here," and grab him by the neck, and he was gone. I remember my wife and I have been going through Star Trek, the original series Star Trek movies, and in the fifth movie where they go try to find God at the center of the galaxy, Spock literally knocks out a horse by grabbing its neck.
That's the one where they saved the whales?
That's awesome.
No. That was the fourth one, which was equally bad.
Okay, yeah.
The fifth one
I thought that was the low point. Awful. I thought the whale one was the low point, but I could be wrong. Because that's when they go back in time, right?
No, yeah, that is it's not great. But man, the fifth one is just god awful. You want to talk about bad movies? That's a bad movie.
Why are you hating on a movie from the 80s? What's going on?
Well, there just wasn't enough cocaine involved.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, he's not saying all 80s movies are good. Not all movies can be Gremlins.
Just the cocaine-fueled movies are good.
1984 was the best year for movies.
Snobby Bobby, I think, says 1988's better, so you guys might have to fight.
I will gladly fight Snobby Bobby. 1984, if you go look at the top 10 movies, every single one of them is a classic. Every single one of them. And Terminator's not even in the top 10 grossing movies for that year. That's how many like classics there are in
Stone Cold
1984.
Killer,
yep. Mm. It's all classics. Every single movie that came out that year is a classic.
Is that the year of Back to the Future? I think so.
No, that was 85.
Oh, okay. 85. Yeah.
Mm. But that movie, I mean, that year has just all classics all the time.
See, Snowy Bobby, he's going to fight you.
1988 okay. For life, but 84 does rule, though.
Mm.
So he's got a point. All right, well, let's get into that final summary and review, Robert.
Ghostbusters. That's a good one. Oh, okay. Yeah, you want to talk about this movie, this James Bond movie? I don't even know. I think when I first moved out here, I watched all the Bond movies like you did. And I remember having a good time with Goldfinger and maybe a few others. And then when they got into the modern ones, they were not great, but I think Casino Royale was pretty good. This was one of those forgettable ones that, as much as asshole wants to say that this is like a groundbreaking, genre-defying film, I guess you got to give it some props for that. I guess. I don't know enough about it. I don't know if this was... because every other time I've seen a Bond movie, they're famous for aping what's popular at the time. Bond movies are not famous for being innovators. They're famous for, hey, what's popular? God, putting some skis on a car and then driving it around. Bungee jumping. Okay, we'll have Bond bungee jump in this one. Okay, they'll skydive in this one, or they'll do whatever. They'll parasail. So Bond parasails in a movie. It's just whatever is popular, they'll have Bond do it and somehow work it into the plot. They're fun films. They're like popcorn movies, like Dan said. Their audience kind of like just turn your brain off and enjoy it for a while. But this one I found like ponderous and slow. And maybe I've just been spoiled by recent Bond films that are far more tight, far more action. But this is just, I mean, as much as I like Connery, I think that, you know, I'm glad these movies like launched his career. I enjoyed a lot of his later work. And he's competent here. He's definitely got a certain amount of charisma and presence. That's undeniable. There's a reason why he's the star of the film. But I didn't find the actual plot, which was set up in the beginning to be, who, get ready for this one. This one's going to be a real corker because you got the super mega chess brain who's going to duel of the mind with James Bond. But at no point in this movie does James Bond really do anything like super smart to counter this mega brain. At no point is he like super clever and he figures out, you know, all the machinations. He basically has to be told by this Spectre guy that, oh yeah, I'm Spectre. And he's like, oh crap, Spectre. I mean, he figures it out. Oh, you're not with Russia. then you must be a Spectre. But you know what I mean? Like, he's not, you know, he wins because he's so sexy and he knows really good judo chop moves, I guess, which is kind of the joke about why James Bond in this era is a joke. So, you know, they were doing their best at the time, but, you know, I guess for $2 million, it buys you a lot of rear screen projection. I'm sorry. I'm shitting all over this film. I didn't enjoy it. This isn't a fun James Bond movie. When I go to see a James Bond movie, I want to have fun. And I found a few scenes fun, like the opening with the Blofeld and whatnots, and they're setting it up. And then the final fight scene, and not the final fight scene, the fight scene with the Spectre agent. Those were some fun bits. But other than that, it was a whole lot of boringness in between. And I was just bored. So I'd give you this 4.5 fighting fish out of 10, but they are bored. 4.5 fighting fish. The half of a fighting fish is the one that's the eaten back half, and it's sinking to the bottom up the little fishbowl.
Wow. Okay. Well, a pretty poor score there. Professional asshole. Can you present your case?
Well, I believe, as a genre setting and defining film, you're talking about, a lot of experimentation with new types of storytelling and new types of stunt work and new types of special effects that weren't being used before. Robert pointed it out right there. I mean, this movie was made on a budget of $2 million, which even, back then is going to come out to like, $25 million in today's money, which is just not a lot. I mean, imagine a genre defining special, entertaining movie that people still enjoy watching 60 years later, made on $25 million, that broke, pretty much every box office record at the time. You're talking about like Deadpool is something that's close, where it was made on a budget of $30 million and, broke every record and was enjoyable and people still watch it. Even then, it's, I don't think in 50 years people will be watching Deadpool. But in addition, as Daniel, as you pointed out, it introduced a lot of the James Bond tropes that were picked up afterwards. It wasn't just the introduction of the scantily clad woman in leotard at the beginning, but the quips and the specialized devices. They introduced Q in this movie. He wasn't in Dr. No. They introduced the specialized weapons and gadgets for him, and eventually that ends up almost becoming Bond's downfall because he's so over-reliant upon those things, like in the Roger Moore era, and they're so ridiculous, like a buzzsaw Rolex type thing. But in the early days, when you just have a booby-trapped briefcase with a hidden knife and some hidden bullets and some hidden money in it, that's very reasonable, very, very, settled for something that you could get through customs. And the plot in and of itself is fairly simple, although I will admit that, the plot is so simple that they have to elaborate upon it by adding in what are inherently unnecessary scenes. And I'll admit that the helicopter scene was brought in simply to make the movie more interesting and to show what they could do with stunt work, and practical effects. But yeah, it's just go to Istanbul, meet the girl, get the Lecter machine, get back home. That's the entirety of the plot. But nonetheless, I couldn't criticize this movie any more than I could criticize any Hitchcock movie. I mean, Psycho has been done far better since Psycho first came out, but I can't criticize Psycho because it was the first movie that got people actually scared about a thriller, about a murder mystery. So, I give it props. I give it love. I know I could beat the shit out of my grandfather, but I still respect him.
All right. And what's your score in Japanese fighting fish?
I was going to say, actually, it gets an 8.5 women slaps.
Okay.
8.5 slaps out of 10 slaps?
Yep.
Holy slap. All right.
All right. Well, thank you guys both for that. Now I have to kind of harken back on my nostalgia for this, and in recalling this film prior to watching it again, it seemed like the train, it took forever to get to the train. The train is the thing that I remember from this. Like, this is like the train Bond film, you know? In the context of this being the very second one, like, we have the ability with the hindsight to know that they made 38 or some odd more of these, and that this established a lot of the tropes that we see later. But an audience member, a moviegoer at the time, is probably looking at this as a very, you know, thriller film, you know, and like a sequel to a movie that overperformed. So it would be like seeing, you know, the second, like Terminator 2 after seeing Terminator 1, and then Terminator, the franchise after that, kind of goes downhill pretty rapidly. They haven't quite gotten to 40 of them yet, but I wouldn't put it past them to try it. But I think that this is probably rated high in many people's lists because of the nostalgia factor for it. I think that this is one of the few films, despite all the, you know, patriarchal woman abuse in this, that it is believable. The love interest, like, there is some chemistry between, I think her name is Daniela Bianchi, and Sean Connery. And this is one of the few films where there actually is kind of that connection, until, I want to say, Casino Royale, when you kind of believe Daniel Craig's into Vespa. But, you know, all those ones in between, it becomes a little bit more on the misogyny end and less on the believable romantic end. But overall, I think that it's actually a pretty good film. It does, well, I'll rephrase that. I think that there is a good 90-minute film in this film. You just have to cut out like 15, 20, 30 minutes of this extraneous nonsense that's kind of injected in just to like add some action, add some spy-ness. And I feel like a re-edit of this could actually make it a pretty tight film and make it a lot better. However, I'm going to give this 007 as my score because I have to be a dork about the score. So there you go. That's our episode.
We should just rename this Robert and Two Simps debate a movie.
Robert and Two Simps watch a movie and talk about it. It's pretty catchy. Pretty catchy. All right. Well, Professor Asshole, thank you for joining us for this episode of The Last Nighters, and we will have your prior appearances. I think the most recent was Edge of Darkness. You've also been on for 310 to Yuma. You've been on for the greatest Thanksgiving film of all time, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and I think a few other things as well. So I'll put all of those on the show notes page, and that can be found at lastnighters.com/153. And Robert, why don't you tell me what they can win if they choose to support what we do here?
Oh, man. Daniel's talking about me potentially stealing Snobby Bobby's idea and giving like a drawing of supporter, you know, to at a certain level or not. They do it at the $5 level. I don't know if I want to go that low, but we'll see. I he might be able to convince me. He's also got me working on some spread for the Voluntarist comic book, or at least I'm supposed to be working on that, which I have been doing a very good job avoiding. So, you normally win a whole lot of virtual hugs and thanks and just the feeling of superiority that you get by supporting us, which is a normal feeling. So that's something. Don't discount that. That's important. You can do that at the Patreon, get the monies, and then you can also go to Trubster.com and buy some merch. This is the time to do that with the holidays coming on us. So, leave a review, leave a like, leave a subscribe. We look forward to all the comments, all the pushback, all the negativity, all the positivity, all the, I can't, as a committed lurker myself, I can't fault you for just listening and then turning it off and then going on to the next thing. I just appreciate you for listening. So thank you very much for that.
Right. We're pretty strong lurkers here on the this show. I lurk often on the Dave Smith show, Part of the Problem. I lurk on the occasional Tom Woods show, among others. And I also lurk in a few private Facebook groups. Well, now MeWe groups, because I'm getting excommunicated from Facebook, I think.
Yeah, how is the MeWe?
It's a little awkward, But content is king, and that's where all the cool kids are going. So if you want to be with the cool kids, you got to go where the cool kids hang, down by the park and smoke.
Yeah, you better get on there because I deleted my Facebook group. It's all on MeWe now.
Yeah, we'll get you in. Yeah, so look us up, Daniel Elwood, on the old MeWe. Send me whatever contact request, whatever GoBots version of Transformers they're using for the language of Facebook into MeWe speak. And Robert, next week we're going to be inviting another guest who's been on many, many times in the past. It's Jared Wall of Anarcholand and Breaking Liberty, coming back on to talk about his favorite movie of all time. He's mentioned it when we did Hotel Rwanda, that his favorite movie was an Indian film called Three Idiots, and how appropriate that you and I and he will be reviewing a movie called Three Idiots.
Yeah, I remember him talking it up quite a bit. I forget what the plot line was, but I'm looking forward to it. We haven't done a Bollywood film yet, so I'm stoked.
Yeah, it should be pretty awesome. So we'll be doing that next week. And I think it's on the old Amazon Prime, so it won't cost us much more than a dime to watch that.
Sick.
All right. Well, Professional Asshole, thanks again. Do you have any final words? And are you able to stick around for the Patreon bonus content? Just a little bit longer. I know it's late.
I will definitely stick around, but I have no final words. I am going to reserve judgment and all my extra words until afterwards so that I can chew out Robert for his poor his poor review of this movie, of this amazing, excellent movie.
All right. Yeah, give the
legendary film
something to look forward to if they crack open their wallets right now and contribute to the Hear Robert Get Cussed Out in the Bonus Content Fund. So that we can buy a new Ferrari Testarossa like Dr. Dre. So go to lastnightairs.com.
Yeah, we get with the fins on the side, right? 80s style? Like my
He's
going to
get pimp slapped by a simp.
Does it come with like a gallon of cocaine?
Yeah.
Gallon? We don't measure by the gallon. We measure by the kilo.
Yeah, we'll use the pure. Tommy? All right. Well, that's been our episode on From Rush With Love. You can find the show notes more at lastnightairs.com/153. And we will bid you good night from last night. All right, before we get to the actual Patreon bonus content, we do have a few more months of actual anarchy. So before the smackdown that will occur, I have one final question. So, Robert, you're going to play the role of Nate Robinson and
get knocked the fuck out.
Be the YouTube guy who knocked him out, Jake Paul. Yeah, so that'll be a lot of fun. But I do have a question, or just a point to bring up in this final couple of minutes. Apparently, the guy who played Karen Bay, he was dying of cancer as the film was progressing, and he couldn't even finish his scene. So the director Terrence Young was his body double for a couple of like the cover shots, I think at the gypsy shootout, like from the back. But apparently this guy was one of 91 people out of about 270 who were making a film with John Wayne in the Nevada deserts a few years prior to this, like in the 50s, near nuclear testing. And 91 of those people got cancer and died of it, including John Wayne. And I didn't know that until I was looking into this film and in reading through like the Wikipedia and whatnot. So I found that fascinating, and I'll find a way to put that on the show notes page because it's pretty interesting. I know that the Duke isn't frozen, as Dennis Leary says, and they're going to thaw him out when whatever it was when he sings the I'm an Asshole song. But he died of cancer, but apparently it's related to this nuclear testing that they were downwind of while they were making a film.
So government killed John Wayne.
Allegedly. Yeah. Yeah. We're going to fact check it. And I'll put that on the show notes page, actualanarchy.com/210. But had either of you guys heard about this stuff? And one last thing about the guy who played Karen Bay. When he went to the hospital, when he could no longer shoot this film, he smuggled a gun into the hospital and shot himself rather than succumb to the cancer. Like he took himself out, which I mean, he must've been having a tough go of it, but yeah, wild stuff.
History is wild, man. And it's only far wilder than you can imagine. I did not know any of that. That's quite interesting to me. And that kind of thing does fascinate me. I wonder what were the failures, probably, in what government didn't, you know, alert people to, didn't want to admit to the radiation dangers in the area.
Yeah, all speculation, of course, but yeah, I'm sure that it was all like top secret as well. And it probably had to do with, like, you know, weather pattern, wind patterns and whatnot. Additionally.
Yeah. Do you know what film they were shooting?
No, I don't recall, but I will put that on the show notes page and also shoot you the link tonight after we do the Patreon bonus content.
Ooh, spicy.
Sorry, Robert, you froze for a moment there. Professional asshole, any final comments from you related to any of that stuff?
No, I didn't know that either, actually. So that's an interesting piece of trivia to find out. I was always under the impression that the Duke died of lung cancer because he was a big smoker. But even then, I mean, I've read a couple of studies that have suggested that the real danger with smoking cigarettes specifically, isn't so much the tobacco or the nicotine, but the fact that they use phosphorus as a fertilizer, and that binds with atmospheric polonium. So that's, you know, one of the reasons why you'll hear statistics that'll say something like, if you smoke a pack a day, that's equivalent of like 70 or 75 chest x-rays a year. It has nothing to do with the, you know, there's nothing to do with
tar or whatever.
It has everything to do with the fact that it's binding atmospheric polonium, so you're smoking radioactive substances into your lungs. Mm-hmm. So, but I mean, it makes sense. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if for some reason they're filming out in New Mexico or wherever, and they decide to do that. You know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
I mean, sure. I'm sure it was cheap to shoot out there.
Oh yeah. Well, and most of New Mexico is government owned anyways. The entire state is basically exists so the government can have laboratories.
Yeah.
And blow stuff up.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, Doug, thanks again for being our guest, and we'll get into post-show content, Patreon, Kathleen Turner Overdrive after this. You can find the show notes more at actualanarchy.com/210 and join us next week as we talk about Three Idiots with our buddy Jared Wall. And we'll see you guys all next week. Maximum freedom, everyone. Peace out.
Chipmunks. CHIPMUNK. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot.